Ben, welcome to Think Visual with Shapeshifters. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking forward to having a nice conversation with you today. I don't think we've had, we've had a lot of run-ins, I guess.
Run-ins? Sounds violent.
in the past year, I feel like it's been always a rush thing.
We always we're always running around. And, yep.
Yeah, so was it run around? So I used the wrong word. Yeah, but it'd be good to just hear about who you are and a bit of your journey. So maybe you can start there. Tell us a little bit about you, what you do today, and how you got here.
Awesome. So I generally describe myself as a designer, coach, and founder. I started Dynamic 4 back in 2001, and we're a social enterprise in B Corp. And everything that we're focused on and what we specialize in is, how do we bring together regenerative leadership, design, and innovation? How do we bring that set of things together to then help create the conditions for people and communities to be happier and for us to all live on a nice, clean, healthy planet? So that's kind of what I get up to now. That doesn't necessarily mean much. We can get into that. Are we doing that now?
If you want, you can go ahead. I was going to say,
are we still doing dry run? Or... When do we cut over to game time?
We're not going to let you know. We're not going to tell you.
It's whenever whenever it sounds good and you're happy.
You just keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
Up to you. Do you want us to restart?
I reckon let's go. Otherwise,
yeah,
I'm going to
keep going. Yeah.
As in keep going, keep or going. You're going to do an edit?
Yeah, we'll do it.
Yeah, we'll edit where we think we need to. Just keep going.
Okay. Alan's the director, so okay. Let's go.
All right. So
that sounds like a mouthful, but also like a very incredible endeavor, like a big one.
It brings together a lot of moving parts, and sort of my backstory will outline some of those different threads that are sort of integrated. But yeah, everything from working in boardrooms through to pixels and DevOps and everything in between. Wow. So that's my happy place, being able to work at the big vision, purpose, strategy level. But then how do you bring those ideas to life and make them real and deliver the change that you want to see? And that's all through the product and service and experience layers, all the way through to what pixels end up where on the screen, and all the infrastructure and back end of the DevOps, and how does that come together as enterprise and solution and tech architecture as well.
Incredible. Yeah.
Fun.
Yeah. Sounds like fun. Yeah. Do you have a team that you work with?
So at the moment, Dynamic 4 is me solo primarily. A few players that sort of bring in for different bits and pieces around different parts of the business, but very much a collaborator model. So on different engagements, work with different people. Sometimes that's bringing other people in or working with other people on a project, but always working with the in-house team. So I'm a pretty embedded part of multiple in-house teams. So it feels like I have lots of teams as opposed to Dynamic 4 was never about building a big empire or anything like that. It's ranged in sizes over the years from me sort of being the main solo person and as a vehicle for that, through to sort of 12, 15 people, depending on what I've been working on and the keys, that's sort of the main focus over the years, which has ebbed and flowed over the last, what are we at? Almost 24 years.
Wow. So tell us a little bit about this journey that you've been on.
So the journey of how I got there, I left school when I was a couple of days after I turned 17, so year 11. It was the end of the school year, and I knew I wasn't going to uni because that's not the background I come from. I grew up in the trades, so grew up as a brickie. Dad retired a few years ago, but my life from when I could walk through to school was being a brickie's labourer, carrying one brick at a time from the brick stack, the pallet would be delivered out the front to where Dad needed it out the back, mixing mud, mortar, raking out, laying bricks. That was how I spent my time before starting school. And then wow. School holidays was doing more of that. So very much that's my sort of background and history. And I did horticulture, worked in a wholesale nursery as work experience in my last year of school. And so I wanted to be a landscaper. So I wanted to bring together the hard landscaping, so the bricks and that structural stuff, soft landscaping with plants and horticulture. And I was doing a little bit of landscape design as well, so I could then bring those pieces together. So I went and worked in this nursery as work experience, and then I had one day off, and on that day, Cor Finstra, who owned the nursery, called me and said, you start tomorrow. So I had one day off, and I thought I was going to have a nice summer break, and it was straight into the nursery. Did that for 6 months, and then it got really cold, and I had this random opportunity to go and work at Westpac in the back office of Westpac. So wow. I switched from the trades, and at 17, found myself wearing a suit going into the city and working in banking. So yeah, that was 93. That's next month in May. That will be 32 years wow. that I've been working in banking and finance. So that banking and finance has been something I started in 93 and still work in banks and financial services today. So it's continued all the way through. Lots of different types of roles. That's a rabbit hole I'll steer away from for now. And the other thing that sort of happened during that time, around that time, was in 94, I started my first startup as well. So accidentally started a snowboard company where we designed and made our own snowboards called Gangster Snowboards. So I used to ride a lot. And so that was my very first startup. And we weren't calling it a startup. That language wasn't something that we knew. It was just sort of something that organically happened. And growing up with my dad always was, you know, ran his own bricklaying business, which is probably overstating it. He laid bricks and he worked for himself and had apprentices and laborers and stuff. But the business skills was something that I learned from dad, not necessarily in good sense in terms of making money. You'd normally make a loss in most jobs, so it was a different way of doing business. So, but yeah, that idea of entrepreneurship, again, not the language used, but you just go do your own thing, and that was a possibility. So that naturally led into going and doing this snowboard startup. We made a bunch of boards. Still one of my favorite boards that I ever owned. I used to love riding that. Nice 155 with a nice side cut. So I ended up being the, and again, not the language at the time, but the CTO. I sort of did a lot of the hardware design, the side cut radius that we wanted, the flex, found a manufacturer who would make our custom boards. My mate designed the graphics, and who was my co-founder, and Gangster Snowboards happened.
Amazing. So did this all just, you said accidentally?
Yeah, everything's accidentally.
Everything is accidental. Yeah. You just, okay. Did they, I guess they were connected in terms of business. Actually, how is the financial, you going to the financial services, connected to any of that?
It's
was
not.
There any connection?
No. It was one of those completely accidental things
wow.
where my best mate growing up, who grew up in the same suburb, he went and got a job at Westpac. So it was actually his job that he had grown out of and got promoted. And so when they asked him if he knew anyone, he put my name forward and I went for my two or three interviews and got the nod. So yeah, growing up working in a bank was the furthest thing I could think of as an option for me or possibility or even something I'd want to do. Funnily enough, in that last year of school, I did these little Polytech taster courses. We went and did it for a few weeks at the Polytech, and I did landscape design, CAD, and banking as three subjects. So, you know, even at 16, I was exploring different possible things. Not really, I sort of had in my mind landscaping because that's something I enjoyed. But yeah, no master plan, mostly just saying yes and accidentally ending up in stuff and being very lucky because of that.
And was that, so how did you go from that first startup to, how many startups have you started?
I've done over 20 startups over the last 30 odd years.
Wow. Is there a reason or a pattern that you found looking back?
It's sort of an irrational optimism and naivety. I think to be a founder, you need those two things. When you know too much, and I mean, if you don't have that crazy optimism bias, then you just won't do a startup anyway. But you also need to not know too much, otherwise your risk profile is too informed and it's just too risky. So it's
that
important
makes sense,
to be
yeah.
a little bit naive, And then also just see something that you care about, something that's hopefully you find fun, but a problem that you actually care about, and then go through the process of seeing what you can do about that and taking a, you know, an experimental approach, testing and learning. In the later years, over the last sort of 10 to 15 years of doing startups, having that sort of mindset, I think also takes a lot of pressure off of actually the idea of a startup is to go find out if there is something here and how can I go learn that as quickly and cheaply as possible at lowest risk. And if the evidence says, no, there's nothing here, that you follow that evidence, so you don't get it too tied up in your identity, which is hard. But I think that's an important part of the process. So yeah, startups has just been something, again, completely fallen into, aside from Dynamic 4, where solo founder from day one, every other startup I've been a co-founder. So, and most of them, it's more that I have then jumped in and helped someone on their idea as opposed to it was my sort of grand vision for something. Mm-hmm. So very comfortable being the co-founder and normally more in that strategy, design and tech sort of role, normally trying to partner and co-founder with someone who's very strong on the marketing sort of side, because that's where I'm weakest. So always relied on co-founders that you go do the demand generation side. I'll look after supply side and product. And as part of that, I'll do the COO role as well and do all the finances. And I'm happy with all of that, but you go raise money if we need it and you go find customers because I'll go look after the craft. You go look after the selling.
And how did this all converge into Dynamic 4? I assume that's how it
happened. Well, it's so that's sort of in the Dynamic 4 was actually my second startup. Not that I ever really even thought of it. And it's evolved. Currently working on version 9.0 of the business model. So I've, about 15 years ago, I went back and sort of versioned the different major iterations. So it's been version 8.x since 2021. And over the last few years, sort of been trying to work out what version 9 would be. And so it's still a work in progress, but business model is always iterating. So 2001, I had just moved to London. So the other sort of travel part of the story is grew up in Sydney, moved to Wellington, New Zealand when I was 10, lived there until I was 24, came back to Sydney briefly, went to London for 7 years, and then came back. And so it was in that 7 year period that I was in London that I started Dynamic 4. So got to London, the market, job market was absolutely dead in 2001. This is a month or two before 9/11. And so even just the job market was already dead. It's always quiet over summer. Then 9/11 happened, and that's put even more uncertainty. It was also the time of the dot-com crash as well. So arguably not a great time to be trying to start your own business. And I wasn't actually looking to start my own business. Again, it was accidental. So I thought I'd just go and get another job in a bank. You know, I had 8 years of banking. So you jump in, do some banking, project management, portfolio management, strategy design, tech type stuff. More like I'd been doing, and the job market was absolutely dead. And so I then gave myself 2 weeks to find a job, because I don't sit around and before I just go and take any job. So worked in a bar, went for some really funny job interviews, but worked in a bar and worked in the gym. So the other thread alongside sort of banking and finance and that large scale change, and then startups at how do you get something off the ground with nothing? The other sort of thread that's been there since I was 12. So started bodybuilding when I was 12, started mind body work when I was in my mid-teens, qualified as a personal trainer just before I moved to London. So I'd sort of been doing that practice myself for a long time, training others unofficially, same as I was teaching people to snowboard unofficially. Didn't have my calls for those things. And so when I moved to London, I was able to go get a job in a gym. And as part of that, I was working the gym and the bar because they go well together. And the other thing I then did was I went around the corner to Pilates Institute. So they were based around the corner from where I was, the gym I was working at. And so went and had a chat to them about getting my Pilates qualifications. And they said, you need to have been working in a gym and doing fitness training for at least 2 years before you can even do the qualifications. Mm-hmm. And I said, I haven't done that. I've been, you know, training people since I've early teens, and I've got my quals, but I've only just started working in the gym. So they asked what I had been doing, and I mentioned sort of the strategy, design, tech, financial services, etc. And Malcolm, who was the co-founder of Players Institute, said, we've got a virus on our server. Do you reckon you can fix it? And I said, I'll have a look. And I fixed it. And Dynamic 4 was born. So so the reason for Dynamic 4 is it's Dynamic 4, the numeral, but it's a shortcut for FOR. So Dynamic 4 Fitness, Dynamic 4 Technology were the two major branches in the early 2000s. So teaching Pilates, teaching spin, lots of personal training clients, especially around Pilates. And then also doing all the strategy, design, tech with small businesses, especially in the fitness industry and the hospitality industries, funnily enough. So it was this interesting combination. Moved then into back into financial services and banking, and a mix of clients around social enterprise, purpose-driven business, but still in financial services as well. So it's a weird, convoluted tale, yeah. But that well-being side, and I was, you know, mind-body work, teaching it, including meditation in my classes and that type of thing as well. So that's kind of the thread that continues today when I talk about well-being and have it embedded into habits and workflow and ways of working. Some people might think I've jumped on the bandwagon as it's become popular, but I was doing this stuff in the 90s when it was considered pretty fringe and woo. Now, luckily, we've got a strong Western evidence base behind it, and it's much more accepted, and people sort of give it more credibility, even though, you know, these practices are centuries old and thousands of years old.
What an incredible journey.
So it's all those threads still all come together today. So what I do now is an integration of all that I've ever done, as opposed to these major, I'm going to do this now. Mm. Being endlessly curious, always learning, but always look to bring the pieces in and sort of thread all the pieces together.
That's great. And how does visual thinking come into all of that? I know you have a little bit of a different, I guess, way of processing things.
Yes, I have a different relationship to many with visual thinking, in that I don't think visually, so I don't think in pictures or imagery, and I don't have memories that are stored as images at all, which I will come to. So my relationship with visual thinking is, I've always valued myself and seen other people value more about the visual communication aspect than the way of thinking. Mm. So I don't have the ability to use it as a way of thinking, because it actually gets in the way of me trying to think, because I don't have that processing. So if I try to do that, that actually makes me think worse, which I know is different to most people who will be watching this, especially in the visual thinking community, that I'm the extreme opposite. But I have always valued the power of visual communication. One, probably less for myself. There's an element of it helping me communicate, but mostly I'm doing that through a communication design lens of, I know that the majority of people who I'm working with and speaking with, that they value imagery. And so come at it more from, you know, a human-centered design perspective than it helps me think and communicate. I'm actually doing it from trying to help articulate and communicate in a visual way that other people can then engage with and remember and process. So I'm doing it from their learning style, not my style.
That's really interesting. So maybe we start back in the no visual thinking or memories,
yep,
in terms of images. Talk a little bit about that, and then we can talk a little bit about
how... might make more sense, the framing of it.
Yeah.
Yep. So aphantasia, of the... a label that was only created in 2015 as sort of a name for people who don't have or have lower fidelity versions of visual imagery.
Yep.
It seems to have also then come in to also cover multi-sensory aphantasia, so not just images, but also auditory and other sort of sensory data. And it seems that I've at least got, I have multi-sensory aphantasia, and I don't have images and I don't have auditory. Not as I talk with other people and, you know, you start get, most people either don't think about it for themselves and then very rarely talk about it with anyone else. Of how do you actually think, and not the metacognition aspect of what's the content and the scripts and the patterns of thinking, but the mechanisms of thinking. So we don't even do the metacognition of, you know, the content of what we're thinking and why. That's more through meditative practice and reflective writing, etc., and mindfulness in general. The but then the mechanisms of what's actually going on, what mechanics are happening in my head comparative to how other people might be experiencing it. And I think we all kind of assume that we're all, you know, small margins of error different. We might have different preference and stuff, but everyone's head's the same.
Yeah.
And that's not true from a cognitive bias and all of our tuning of our 180 plus cognitive biases. But it's also not true from just basic brain wiring. And that's without even getting into theory of mind. So just from a straight neuroscience perspective, our neurology is all quite diverse. So aphantasia, I think of it as a neurodifference. It's neurodivergent, but even a phrase like neurodivergent implies or explicitly states that there's a norm, a typical, and I don't think that's particularly accurate either. I normally think and talk about that as a matter of zoom. If you zoom all the way out, all human brains are pretty much the same. If you zoom in a bit, you might get a distribution curve. You're going almost a sort of in the body of the curve, you know, might be a few outliers. You zoom in again and you go one to one and compare two people, and then they're completely different. So the idea of neurodivergence, and I'm going to, everything I say is from my own experience, not trying to cast onto other people. But neurodivergence, one, it sort of implies or explicitly states that there's a norm. I think data shows that's not the case. It's no such thing as an average human. ABS data, every time they do the census of what's an average Australian look like, it's like, yeah, that person doesn't exist. So back into kind of the visual thinking and the aphantasia. Oh, the other thing with aphantasia is it's a spectrum. So some people, and I seem to be more towards this end of the spectrum slash possibly all the way there, of absolutely zero visual imagery. I have zero auditory that I can recall. And the so it's a knowing, it's like a deep knowing of these things, as opposed to I can actually reconstruct imagery. And it's kind of weird because I have an extremely powerful memory. So it's one of my superpowers. And over the years, people have said to me, you know, have you got a photographic memory? And
wow.
Which I find quite funny because I've always said, nope, I have the opposite. I literally can't create mental imagery. So there's then other people who have kind of faded out to a lower fidelity mental imagery, all the way through to the other end of the spectrum, hyperphantasia, where there's some people who actually have, like, think and have their memories in full animation, cartoon, hyper-realistic color. You know, so there's a big spectrum of different sort of mental imagery and experience going on there. And then for auditory as well, there's some people that literally walk around with a track, like a piece of music playing out loud as they experience it in their head that they can't change. And it's just the same piece of music going over and over and over that they're hearing as if they're hearing it through their ears externally. I have, music's my everything. I love music. Been over to 550 gigs, so I love live music as well. And I can't hear a single piece of music that's of any of the music I love. I can't see an image of any of the people in my life or any place I've been. And I think that's where photos, and before I always knew that I, well, for a long time, since my teens, I knew that I was primarily an auditory processor and that the visual, I appreciated the visuals, but and very particular about the visuals because I think that's where I do a lot of pattern matching. But I primarily process from an auditory point of view, and the way those memories are then stored is not visual at all. But and photos have kind of been a backstop to that, sort of almost like a since I got my first digital camera in 2000, and it's basically been through the ease of digital photography, a constant photo journal. So taking photos has always been, or for a long time now, been a sort of key part of my external augmented memory for the imagery side. And in the 90s, I digitized my massive music collection, so I'd always have my music with me, which I think was a way of sort of always having that stimuli on hand for my auditory input, because once it's in, it doesn't come back out.
Wow.
In that form.
I have a lot of questions. I guess the first question would be, so when you say, actually I'll start with memories. You say you have a very strong memory. How do you recall things? So if it's not auditory and it's not visual.
Yeah. So the analogy, and I'm not good at analogies, and I think partly because of this. Also, the other thing I want to quickly mention is it's very easy with any of these types of things to then fall into sort of the reduction fallacy of there's this one attribute about someone, therefore all it explains all these other attributes or preferences. And that's definitely a fallacy. It's oversimplifying and then extrapolating. So that reductionism and then extrapolating is a very dangerous thing to do, but seems to happen more and more now. So there's lots of other intersectionality and reasons for these things.
Yep.
But the memories, the analogy I use for it is I don't have the content of the memory. I have the metadata. And so I've got extreme detail of all the metadata, of here's all the things that happened, here's all the data points about it, but the actual rendering of the content of that image, I don't have.
Very good analogy. Okay.
Okay, yeah, that worked.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, actually.
So it means that my memories, and might be stretching the analogy too far now, are comparatively lightweight, because I'm carrying a few K of data just around, data, as opposed to megs of, 4K rendering on top. And so being able to recall, store, and the sort of the data detail level, is where my memory is really powerful. So a very quick thing in terms of one of the key models around how memories are stored and recalled. One is that we never recall a fully constructed. Well, memories aren't stored constructed. We reconstruct them on recall. So, and then there's three sort of modes of memory. There's the semantic, which is kind of all that metadata. Here's all the data points of what happened. Mm. There's a spatial, so sense of that 3D and spatial awareness. And then there's the episodic memory, which is all that sensory data of image, auditory, etc. And so I don't have access to any of that episodic memory, but my semantic memory and spatial memory is what I do have. And that's where I can describe full plan, full layouts of who was standing where, who said what, which direction I'm facing.
Is that not visual?
It's spatial,
but
I don't get any imagery for that. And so I can't tell you.
Spatial.
So orientation of people,
yeah.
The layout of the space that we're in, what was sort of around. So that sort of spatial.
Is it a feeling of the.
It's sort of a knowing.
Yeah, like an impression of where everyone and everything was, kind of.
And it's even more than an impression. Like an impression might be what that sort of implies to me is like there's a low fidelity image there and you sort of got, like a relief level painting of it.
Uh-huh.
This is like zero imagery and not even trying to put imagery on top of it. So I'm not trying to render anything. It's just going, okay, so that person was standing there, they're facing that way. Two other people are facing this way and be able to describe and that particular one I just did there was from something where I don't know how old I am, but when I've told people that scenario, I was 2 or 3.
Wow.
And so I've got these very explicit memories from a very young age, but I don't have any of the content or the imagery or the actual literal sound in my head. but I can tell you what the conversation was about, who said what, how I felt, how they felt, what their reaction to certain things were. So all of that stuff is there, but I just don't have the high fidelity imagery or sound to go with it.
Okay. Yeah, very interesting. And so when you, from memories into processing, so in the moment you're processing the information, how does that work if it's not, yeah?
For me, and all of this is for me, so people who experience aphantasia or have their own experiences of it, and so yeah. So explicitly for me, I can surprisingly multitask, but and relatively well. You know, neuroscientists would disagree with that, but I can actually multitask pretty well. But one thing I can't do is if I try to take notes or sketch while listening and absorbing information, that actually impairs my understanding and processing more than if I do a completely different task at the same time as listening. So if I try to be multimodal, attentive on that piece of content or on that person saying, that will actually make me worse at remembering it than if I literally do something else at the same time.
You did say you're auditory processing. So you I guess as a learner, it's more about listening and learning from what you're hearing.
I think I've definitely got a words carry a lot more meaning for me.
Okay.
Because it's all the other stuff that comes with words. So the connotations, the inflection, the non-verbal, but as part of the verbal, which is sort of a different medium to the visual, which that sounds contradictory, but...
No, it's actually similar to the visual in terms of the visual is... there's the message, but then there's the narrative and the emotion and the image and the style and all of that. So it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
In the words, there's the tone in which they're being said and the...
And somehow all of that stuff seems to resonate and I store it and can recall it, even though I won't be able to say what colour they were wearing because I don't have that. Unless I make a note of remembering that, like a visual element like that, then I couldn't tell you the colour of something.
Yeah.
But then some of the research shows that people with aphantasia actually have better colour recall than people without. There's been some interesting studies done on that.
Interesting. Well, I can talk all day about this, but...
Me too, about all the things.
We'll get a chance to talk about them in a little bit more detail at a later date at the meetup that
we're
having.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
And doing a compare and contrast of different sort of...
Yes, and we've got two people who have experienced the aphantasia, and I think that very different experience. Yep. And then we've got Alan, who's got hyperphantasia, the other end of the spectrum. So it's going to be really interesting.
And just quickly on that, in terms of sketching, no go.
Yeah.
Creating graphics where I can then iterate really rapidly in real time. So type, color, different graphical elements. The graphic design part has always been quite natural to me.
That was the last thing I wanted to ask you, was the communication part. So you do use visuals to communicate.
Yeah.
But so you're saying it's more the graphical part that's a little bit easier. It's because you're seeing it on the spot.
Yeah, because I don't have an image in my head that I'm trying to then represent in a form.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have a knowing sometimes of, I think some pieces could hang together like blah.
And then you see how it's coming
together.
But then
I will rapidly iterate and being able to do, you know, digital graphic design where you can iterate and change type and in real time, you know, close enough to real time get, and without the same type of skill that something like illustration requires. And the iteration of going, thought that would look better, it doesn't, you know, wind it back.
Yep.
No, just that very fast iteration with graphics. So, you know, color graphics, typefaces, layouts, vertical rhythm. The other thing, and this could definitely be falling into that reductionist fallacy, but I think, especially visually, my pattern matching, I have very strong pattern matching, and I think part of that is I know if I've seen it before, but I wouldn't be able to reproduce the thing I've seen before in my head. So okay. I sort of, and so things, and again, this is probably over-explaining and putting too much weight on the aphantasia side, but I've always been very specific and particular about naming conventions, layouts. I will visually see if something's one pixel out, and wow. I'll see that normally quite immediately, unless I've been too close to it. but normally I'll, you know, it's, if things are, the vertical rhythm's off, those types of things catch my eye really fast, because I think I'm, you know, I'm definitely creating patterns and pattern matching and seeking. If that's aphantasia or some other attributes, who knows? But that aspect of visual is something that's, consistency is key for me.
That's incredible. And I would still call this visual thinking. It's just a
it's in
form.
A very different form and for a at different stages. So I can't create it in real time. Like, I'll use visuals, which will then almost always be graphics and imagery to help with visual communication, where I can prepare it and experiment to go, okay, I think this is getting that message across and helping support a message, to use it as a way of thinking, like even writing on a whiteboard, even writing notes on a whiteboard.
Or as a reflective kind of...
and reflective. Activity. So if it's solo and I... But the having it as a real-time thing where other people are involved, and it's used as to, you know, even write notes on the whiteboard, that is extremely taxing and definitely not something I'm good at. And that's without getting into the illustration skills, which are close enough to zero.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Ben. I think we're running out of our time. But if people want to know more about what you do and find you, connect with you online, where should they find you?
The easiest thing would be dynamic4.com. Everything's kind of there. Or on LinkedIn, Ben Pekatich. There's only one.
Yes.
So it's nice and easy. Yeah, the world only needs one. Though there is another Ben Pekatich in Sydney, but it's another rabbit hole. So, yes. You'll find me pretty easily.
Great, great. And you have
the advantage
book,
of having a weird name.
We'll link to your book as well.
Oh, awesome.
In the show notes. All right. Well, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.